Good to see you all this morning. Thank you, Jan, for the readings. When someone, I won't say any name, saw the title of this sermon, she said, "Is this? Are we supposed to understand something from this?" That the sermon actually started with when this magazine came out from Eastern Mennonite University just in the last couple of weeks, and it has on it the picture of the new president and just the back of the old president and what's going on in the picture. And where are they? On a track. So they're taking a metaphor or an image, I should say, from track and field. And what is a relay race? I should have said, and what kind of race is this? A relay. I gave away the clue. But anyway, it's a relay race. And what happens in a relay race? Does anybody know? You pass the baton. And it can be 100 meters. It can be 200 meters. It can be 400 meters, 800 meters. Even I'm sure a mile, or I'm not sure how many levels of relay there are by now. But in a relay race, you've got the one person, like this woman, Shannon, she has to be watching, and they have to practice enough that they know the difference between the likely speed time they need, because they've got 20 meters to hand on the baton. And so what happens is you're watching over your shoulder and you look back and you have a place where it's marked. And what you do ideally is you take off. You totally don't look at that person. You take off, boom, 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 and put your hand back. And if you have done, if you're coordinated with, if you've practiced that enough, you reach back and boom, the baton's in your hand and you go on. What does that, when you think about that image, what does that imply about the people involved? Anything that come to mind? What has to happen? Trust? Yeah, you know, they have to work together enough to trust each other. What else do they need? A routine, practice, timing. Yeah. So the more you practice, the more of those details you get down. And it's pretty rare. I mean, you've seen more than one race where the baton gets dropped. And they get disqualified and so on and so forth. But in passing a baton, both people have to be in good shape. And if you're mismatched, you're just going to mess up. So the image of passing on a baton is a significant image that evokes the need for preparation, the need for trust, the need for repetition, practice, et cetera, et cetera. An image that doesn't require that much is an expression that we hear at different times that, okay, I've got this necklace here. Now, a few years ago, I was traveling somewhere. I was in Barcelona in Spain. And there were some people, a guy came up to me. Anyway, it was evening. Guy came up to me and boom, he grabbed it off, scratched my neck, grabbed my chain off my neck. And it popped. Where did it pop? The clasp. But it wasn't the clasp itself. It was just this little tiny, tiny piece on the clasp. And that was the weakest link, right? So a chain is only as strong as the weakest link. Now, the thing is, the problem with this particular attempted theft was that the weakest link was actually the guy who took it off my neck, because he was so startled by how hard he had to pull and the fact that all of a sudden he had this chain in his hand and it was like hanging like this. I looked at him and said, "What you do that for?" And I grabbed it back and it just slid out of his hand. And so then they were wanting to find me. I said, you really don't want to do that. You've been drinking too much. Let's just forget about it and leave it alone. And they walked off. And so anyway, then when I looked at it, I found out, well, it's really only the clasp. And then I took it to a jeweler. They fixed it, no trouble at all. And I've worn it ever since. And Dorothy never tries to pull it off. So I'm grateful. A third image is how I used to work in my former position. And I in my former role, I didn't really have authority. In the sense I had the authority of representing the agency, Mennonite Mission Network, but it wasn't really authority over the partners with whom I worked. So in other words, I was really for them more of a consultant than anything else. So I would go and I would visit and I would listen for a couple of different things. One, where are the cracks? Where are the issues that sort of indicate that things may not be going very well right now? Another thing I would do is I would listen to the leaders of the organization, and I would listen for signs that they needed help. And what I would do when I'd hear this person needs some help or that person needs some help, I would ask them, what exactly do you think you need? Is it training? Is it accompaniment? What is it that you need? And how do you think would be the best way to get that kind of support? And so sometimes that meant we sent them to the CJP program at Eastern Mennonite University. I sent lots of people there over the years to learn more about peace building. But we trained in, we sent people to seminaries, we sent people to a whole variety of different training institutions. And so the thing there is my job wasn't directly mentoring those people, but it was mentoring in the sense that, like with Kaja Bienvenu, who spoke here a few months ago, he and I are very close friends. But one of the great things about it is that in our relationship, he knows that he's completely safe in terms of whatever. If he's falling apart, fine. If he needs help with this, fine. If he's excelling with this and he needs some advice about X, Y, or Z, fine. But he never had to worry about feeling like things are falling apart. And he was leading a strong and growing institution. And we always found ways to get him the kind of support he needed. But that wasn't me mentoring him, but he still called me his mentor frequently enough. So the point is that, I'm not talking about leaving right now. I'm not looking, but I am thinking about frequently these days, what exactly do we need here? And twice this summer, I heard sermons on Elijah and Elisha. And then 2 weeks ago at the Warwick Williamsburg Retreat Center, Katie Hushman gave a sermon on the midwives, Sifra and Pua, that delivered babies, the Jewish babies during the, when the Pharaoh had said, kill all the babies. Anyway, she talked about being midwives and birthing things and working for salvation and acting for justice. And that, between the two sermons on Elisha, Elijah, and then that one 2 weeks ago, I got thinking, I would really like to spend some more time with prophets. Last week, we gave a little bit of a bit of an intro to this in looking at some of Isaiah's story. And one of the things there, I said that the prophetic movement grew in Israel once they were having kings of their own. The prophets didn't grow really during the time of captivity and slavery and so forth. No, it was once Israel was past the period of the judges and so forth, and they became centered there with Saul and then David and the succession of kings. And they started, the prophetic movement responded to two different things. The one thing was the lack of faithfulness of Israel to God's commands. The second thing that they responded to was oppression, not the oppression of other countries, but the oppression of the Jewish people. And so they became a critique of the kings. That's what they were doing. And now in Elisha and Elijah, we see a couple of different things going on, because Elijah starts out his ministry as, does anybody remember some of the big stories with Elijah? Any thoughts? Battles with Baal or Baal? Pouring water, famine for 3 years, no rain for 3 years. And then what happens? Rain. Why does it happen? Because there's a showdown between Elijah and the prophets of Baal. And what happens? You know, they get bulls, they get bulls, and they put them up for sacrifice. They stock up all this wood and so forth. And, you know, there's this showdown between the two of Elijah and the prophets of Baal. And, you know, he gives them all the time they need to call down fire from heaven, and they can't do anything. And so Elijah says, hey, look, why don't we pour lots and lots of water on this altar? And he's so confident that God will step in that he has them, you know, fill the ditch around the sacrifice. He does, you know, puts lots and lots of water down. And all of a sudden, God sends fire and consumes it. And so Elijah has these demonstrations of power, but they're demonstrations in the context of witness to the kings of Israel. So his witness is political, but it's political within the context of the people of God. Okay? So that's one thing. Now with Elisha, he is designated by God to be to take the baton from Elijah. And he's chosen early on It's found in chapter 19, I think, and he of First Kings, and but he accompanies this community of prophets that Elijah is a part of. So we tend to think about some of these people as lone prophets, you know, but actually they were part of a school, and they were numerous in the school. And so Elijah and Elisha involved in this. And the story that we read this morning is that he knows that Elijah's time is coming. And Elisha already knows that he's been chosen and he's been anointed. He's actually been anointed for this task. But he says, well, he doesn't want to leave the side of Elijah. And they're traveling and going to Bethel and other places. And they get to this point where Elijah says, you know, I know it's coming. It's coming very soon that I will be taken away. Like it repeats in this passage that, do you know that today is the day? It's the other prophets that are saying this. And then when it gets to the point where they had crossed the river, the dry ground, they crossed on dry ground after Elijah struck the water and parted it. When they had crossed, Elijah said to Elisha, tell me what I may do for you before I am taken from you. Tell me what I may do for you before I'm taken from you. So in summary, up until this point, it's kind of interesting because you've got Elisha, who's been chosen by God to succeed Elijah. And they've journeyed together for a significant period of time. He's been like a disciple. He's been mentored by Elijah. And now he gets to this point where Elijah turns and says, I'm going to be taken up today. But what more should I do for you? You know, he puts it straight at him. You know I'm going. And what is his response? His response is, Elisha's response is, please let me inherit a double share of your spirit. Now, you may not know, you may not think about it right away, but it makes me think of a story that I don't think I've shared here. But one time I was in a taxi in Abidjan, Ivory Coast, and I had just come back from Liberia. And I was going to some meetings there in Abidjan. And the taxi driver said to me, so how are things in Liberia? And I told him about all this lack of trust, the infighting that's going on, and that there's all kinds of conflict that's there, and who knows exactly what's going to happen here. And he said, have you ever heard the proverb about the genie and the two brothers? I said, no, I don't know it. He said, well, there were two brothers walking in the woods, and then they heard this voice saying, help, help. And this genie had fallen into a hole, and he couldn't get out. And so they walked over to the hole, and they saw the genie in there, and they said, you know, genie, what's wrong? He said, I've fallen in this hole. Can you help me? They say to the guy, the genie, what will you give us if we help you? And the genie said, thought about it a moment, maybe, I don't know. He said, I will give you a blessing. And to the first brother, the younger brother, I will give double the portion of what the older brother requests. Sounds like a good deal. Who knows? What happens? He gets pulled out of the hole. He says, well, you know, as I promised, the younger brother will get the double portion of what the older brother requests. So the older brother says, let me think about this. And what do you think he says? Any ideas? No, he says, tear out my eye. So what does the brother get? Both eyes pulled out. So in other words, the older brother is unwilling to bless the younger brother. And so when a couple things going on, when I read this story about Elijah and Elisha, Elijah could have said, no way. No way, there's no, I'm making you more powerful than I am. He could have responded any number of ways. But he said, I will give you that blessing if you see me when I leave, when I'm taken up. And so here this chapter have Elisha choosing to follow. So he's followed Elijah very closely from place to place. And now Elijah says, you must, I will give you that double blessing if you see me at my departure. And he does, as they're walking along, the chariot comes and he's taken. And the mantle that Elijah had just used to strike the water and cross the river on dry ground, he threw out of the chariot, and Elisha was able to recover it. So as I was looking at and thinking about this story, I got thinking about what are some of the other biblical passages that talk about succession. Because my argument with the King James, or the, I mean the kings, with kings and like the transition from Samuel to kings to the whole kingship structure is that, you know, first of all, in Samuel, it's very clear that God did not see Israel having a king as a positive thing. He gave them that. He wanted judges. He wanted judges. He wanted a social structure and so forth. But they were a tribal confederacy. And kingship, he knew, would turn them into a nation. God knew that that would take place. And God was opposed to it because why? Because kings demand allegiance. And so God did not really want them to have other loyalties other than God. Right? God wanted direct rule in a sense. And so what happens here is as soon as, you know, how long was Israel a united kingdom? Under how many people? Three. Who were they? Saul, David. As soon as, and what the difference, was Saul David's father? No. Who was David? Jesse's son. But was he chosen by God? Both Saul and David were chosen by God. By the time you get to Solomon, it's who is Solomon? David's son. So very quickly, it moved from being God's choice to the king's choice. And so rejection of God's intervention in the life of the nation. It was a rejection of, it was the tracing of a dynasty. It was a desire to see a dynasty happen. And then as soon as that takes place, we get a divided kingdom. So anyway, succession did not work in Israel. Kingship did not work in Israel. So then we get 100 years later to the time of Christ, and we get this community developing around the ministry of Jesus, around the resurrected Lord. And in the passage that we read from Acts chapter 1, what's taking place there is that they're sort of gathering together and sorting things out right after Jesus has been lifted up and so forth. And they're waiting for the Holy Spirit and so forth. They see the ascension of Jesus. And now they get to this thing where they say, look, you know, to be 12. There were 12 tribes. We need 12 apostles. And so we're going to have to choose a new apostle to be a part of our company, because Judas has betrayed us, and then he's taken his own life. And so now we have to have some way of choosing. So as we've read already, they set some criterion. The person had to have accompanied them, be a part of their group, that school following Jesus, of disciples of Jesus, had to be a part of it from the very beginning of. So right those first days, that person had to be a part of the group. And then they had to be part from the beginning to right now seeing Jesus taken up. So it's kind of mimics which story? Elijah, Elisha, right? It's we witnessed Jesus being taken up. Elijah was taken up in a similar kind of way. And now we need the person who is there. There's a special blessing for that person that we want to have a part of us. And so they identified two people. And then this is the thing I find, I don't know. You know, in Anabaptist circles, we drew lots in many different situations. And often it was, you have, you know, X number of people chosen by the congregation, and then they draw lots, and that's how the next preacher or whatever was chosen. They do this based on this practice here in Acts. So here they're fasting and praying. They've chosen these two people, and now they draw lots, and they say, "Is their heart?" Now we're randomly drawing lots, and not only is the Lord knowing their hearts, the Lord knows how to draw. Kind of a interesting way of trusting. So it's not an election, but it is an election. So anyway. That's how they drew lots, and they cast a lot for them, and the lot fell on Matthias, and he was added to the 11 apostles. Okay, so there's one decision-making process on leadership transitions. It's how the baton was passed. It wasn't directly passed from Judas to Matthias, but there was a process and criterion for his acceptability. Now, the next story was in chapter 13. They're choosing somebody, some people, to go and problem solve within the new churches. And while they were worshiping the Lord and fasting, the Holy Spirit said, "Set apart for me Barnabas and Saul for the work to which I have called them." And after fasting and praying, they laid their hands on them and sent them off. So now what's happened? In this little process of a few months, they moved from a process of drawing lots to, in the context of praying together, hearing God's voice. But then they didn't just leave it at that. God chose these two people. But then they prayed over them, they blessed them, anointed them, and sent them out. So they're, in a sense, it feels like they're making a formal process on the one hand, but it's a process that centers on God declaring what's to happen. So in this last one, in Peter, and now this is a good bit of time later, but there's another shift in the understanding, because Peter's talking to a much broader audience, and he's reflecting on the journey, in a sense. He's journeyed with Jesus, and now he's later in his life. And what does he have to say to them? I'm just going to reread it very quickly, starting with verse 1. Rid yourselves, therefore, of all malice and all guile, insincerity, envy, and all slander. Like infants, long for the pure spiritual milk. If indeed you have fasted or tasted that the Lord is good, I'm sorry. Like new infants, long for the pure spiritual milk, so that by it you may grow into salvation. If indeed you have tasted that the Lord is good. Come to him, a living stone, though rejected by mortals, yet chosen and precious in God's sight. Now, Jesus has been referred to as the cornerstone, the living stone, and so forth. So you're coming to Jesus, but you're also, you, like living stones, let yourselves be built into a spiritual house to be a priesthood. So he's talking about who or what is he talking about? Who is his audience? Any thoughts? Anybody who believes in Jesus. Does that mean us? It's saying that we are the stones. We are the holy priesthood. So what's happened in this whole transition is that God demonstrates through these words and through these acts that God has entrusted God's witness to us. That's what we're about. And of course, now I'm going back to the comment about passing the baton. You know, the thing is, how are we intentionally equipping ourselves for the future? We need to be fit. We need to be attentive to what's going on within the congregation, but also within the broader church. We need to be attentive to the kind of witness that the world needs right now. And we have to align ourselves with what God wants for the world. And what we know most clearly about God's desire for the world, we know that the end game, as we see it in Revelation, is that all nations and people will surround the throne of God. And all ethnicities will be around the throne of God. And so when we talk about talk in ways that are divisive, when we talk in ways that don't honor people of different ethnicities, language groups, and so forth, when we do that, we're working deliberately against God's vision for the world. And so the invitation to us as a congregation isn't to feel, you know, our numbers are down, we got budget issues, and all blah, blah, blah. That's not the problem. The question is, how will we be faithful with what we have right now into the future? That's the question. How do we do the best with what we have? And that's why I've said more than one time, look at you and see a disaster. No, I don't. I see fine folks wanting to be faithful and to walk in the way of the Lord. And that's what I see. And so how are we a reflection of God as Jesus is the living throne, as us being a holy priesthood? How do we be God's presence to this community? And that's the task before us. So, yes, there are different realities to take into account, but that's not the problem. The problem that we have to decide is how we will be faithful and walk in the way of the Lord and be that testimony, that witness, be the priesthood of believers. I'll end it with that.